life can be extremely stressful at times, and this is basically because we are holding on to illusions of control, and because our minds are overthinking and ruminating all the time. In most cases, holding on to things is a waste of energy, and overdoing it causes a lot of mental and even physical pain. Now, Stoic philosophy has several different ideas that help with letting go. 1. Becoming aware of indifference. In Stoic ethics, we can find a system of virtue, vice, and so-called indifference. Now, what most people seem to hold on to are preferred indifference, so much so that these have become the center of their pursuit. Indifference are basically anything that isn't virtue or vice, which means that they don't necessarily lead to misery, but not to happiness either. Hence the indifference associated with these things. Among preferred indifference are wealth, reputation, material possessions, basically the same things that Epictetus points out as not in our control. Now, the thing is that these are not only beyond our control, they don't lead to lasting satisfaction, even though the mind thinks so. Also, not having them will not obstruct our ability to be happy. In regards to the ancient Stoic texts, Seneca has some wise words to say about this. Whoever has largely surrendered himself to the power of fortune has made for himself a huge web of disquietude, from which he cannot get free. If one would win a way to safety, there is but one road: to despise externals, and to be contented with that which is honorable for those who regard anything as better than virtue, or believe that there's any good except virtue, are spreading their arms together in that which fortune tosses abroad, and are anxiously awaiting her favors. End quote. Now, this quote is from a letter to his friend Lucilius. In the same letter, he emphasizes that the mere grasping for externals will never get you the things that you've imagined to get in the first place. The joy of externals is always temporary. Moreover, greedy hands often end up with nothing but frustration. So if we know that, at the end of the day, preferred indifference are simply overrated, and that we can still be happy without them, or with just the basic necessities, we might stop chasing them so much. Or at least, loosen the grip, and know that not having these things is not the end of the world. Isn't that a calming thought? 2. Remember impermanence. The world is completely out of control. Life comes, life goes. Empires rise, empires fall. And it's just a matter of time until planet Earth vanishes because the sun swallows it. The house we live in, the money we have in the bank, the people we love, it's all going down anyway. From this perspective, we may see that it's kind of crazy to spend our lives attaching ourselves, sometimes painfully, to the world around us. The preferred indifference that I previously talked about not only fail to give us lasting satisfaction, they do not last themselves either. This is yet another reason why it's better to let go of them. Emperor and Stoic philosopher Marcus Aurelius observed that change and flux constantly create and recreate the world. I quote, "We find ourselves in a river. Which of the things around us should we value when none of them can offer a firm foothold, like an attachment to a sparrow? We glimpse it and it's gone, and life itself, like the decoction of blood, the drawing in of air. We expel the power of breathing we drew in at birth, just yesterday or the day before, breathing it out like the air we exhale at each moment." End quote. So we could propose ourselves the following lesson in the form of a question. Why hold on tightly to things that are in constant flux? 3. Residing in the present moment. The third way refers to the human obsession with what's in the past and what's yet to come. It's understandable because the past is a source of life lessons, and the future is something we might want to plan for. The problem, however, is that some people live entirely outside the place where life is happening, the present moment. Their worries about the future make them so uptight and sometimes paralyzed, while the heavy burden of the past is resting on their shoulders. Marcus Aurelius was aware of the human tendency to live outside the present moment. I quote, "The present is the same for everyone, its loss is the same for everyone, and it should be clear that a brief instant is all that is lost. For you can't lose either the past or the future. How could you lose what you don't have? End quote. So letting go, in this case, literally means letting go of what you don't have. Sure, you have your thoughts about it in your mind, but thoughts are the fabrication of the mind and don't represent the world around you. They're mere illusions, fantasies, calculations. A mind is a great tool. The Stoics see rational thinking as a gift that sets humans apart from animals and makes it possible for us to live a life of virtue. However, it's important that we use the tools that we're given and not the other way around. It's funny to look at ourselves and see how we quarrel about the smallest things, like the behavior of an annoying coworker during a meeting or the person who cuts us off in traffic. From my own experience, it's very easy to get dragged along by a minor event in a way that a dog is obsessed with a stick. We worry anxiously about the future and endlessly ruminate about the past. But from a cosmic point of view, how significant are the things that we invest so much emotional energy in really? Even though practicing Stoicism can be considered a very serious undertaking, there's also a sense of looseness to find in the words of Marcus Aurelius when he speaks of the insignificance of our lives in relation to the bigger picture. I quote, "The earth will cover us all, and then be transformed in turn, and that too will change, ad infinitum, and that as well, ad infinitum." Think about them, the waves of change and alteration, endlessly breaking, and see our brief mortality for what it is. End quote. In these eternal cycles of life and death, creation and recreation, we are even less than a grain of sand in the Sahara Desert compared to what we are in the universe. This doesn't take away that the human experience is intense and our senses are constantly tingled during our short lives on our tiny blue planet. Sometimes we get so entangled in a human drama that we experience emotional disturbances like anger and anxiety. Some people are obsessed with wealth and fame, willing to make great sacrifices to get to the top, while most likely their names will be forgotten 100 years from now. And even if you belong to the lucky few, whose names will be preserved throughout the centuries, it's still insignificant when we look at it from a wider perspective. Considering the entropic nature of the universe, the Earth will disappear one day. If we don't destroy it ourselves, and the planet escapes the destruction by a meteor, it will eventually be swallowed by the sun when it enters the red giant phase. Who cares, then, how much money you had in your savings account? Who won the Nobel Peace Prize? Even the bloody wars we humans have engaged in will become insignificant. I quote Seneca, "All things move in accord with their appointed times. They are destined to be born, to grow, and to be destroyed. The stars which you see moving above us, and the seemingly immovable earth to which we cling, and on which we are set, will be consumed, and will cease to exist." End quote. The idea of our insignificance could lead some people to despair, but it can also be a very calming thought. The day-to-day problems that caused us so many headaches, the constant striving for goals that we deem utterly important, overanalyzing the past and future, obsessive thinking about what should be and should have been. What if we could view all this from a distance and reduce it to what really is, a mere dot in one of the countless galaxies in the universe? What foundation will be left for worry, greed, or anger? The modern Stoics have turned the musings about humanity's place in the cosmos into an exercise called the view from above. This exercise gives us a temporary break from our daily affairs and puts them in another light. Changing our position towards external things changes the way we think about them, which in turn changes how we feel. It's a Stoic form of meditation to calm the mind. You start the view from above by visualizing yourself within your close and direct environment. It's like you are being watched through the lens of an advanced telescope that's placed thousands of light years away. Imagine an alien civilization that's able to observe Earth in real time, looking at you sitting on a chair or lying in bed in your room. Now, the telescope zooms out a little and focuses on your house, then your neighborhood. You're already quite small in comparison to all the streets and other houses. Now it looks at the city and its environment. See how small you are. It has become impossible to observe you with the naked eye. Then, compared to the vast countries or oceans that surround the city, it has become nothing more than a small dot. The continents are spread around the globe, which predominantly consists of oceans that hold vast areas that we haven't discovered yet. Earth is only a small planet compared to the other planets like Neptune or Jupiter, which, in their turn, are tiny compared to the Sun. The Sun isn't really a big star compared to, let's say, Antares, which is 850 times its size. Both the Sun and Antares are part of the Milky Way, which contains between 150 and 250 billion stars. When the aliens turn the telescope away from our galaxy and direct it outwards, it registers millions, even billions of other galaxies, many even bigger than our own. Meditating on how small we are in the grand scheme of things, how short our lives are, and what we see as important matters less than we think, is both freeing and humbling. As Emperor of Rome, he was the most powerful man on the planet. Yet, as opposed to many of his successors and predecessors, he aimed to live virtuously on a consistent basis. He followed a philosophical school called Stoicism. Part of Stoic philosophy is the ability to keep a calm mind. As a matter of fact, the Stoics believe that humans in a state of flourishing have attained true happiness, which always goes together with inner peace. Needless to say, Marcus Aurelius was a busy man, carrying the burden of leadership over an empire and all the stress that comes from this. His work, Meditations, gives us an idea of how he coped. Marcus Aurelius is famous for his negative visualization, which modern Stoics use as a meditative practice to start the day. I would like to focus on his lesser-known teachings that we can use as practical advice for more tranquil lives. The first one is very simple. Do less. It's a no-brainer, right? In order to become calmer, we should simply do less. Now, it's important to mention that the Stoics hold productivity in high regard, as they see it as a virtue to be industrious. On the other hand, moderation is a virtue as well. So how exactly should we do less when we're supposed to be industrious? Marcus Aurelius observed that people do many things that aren't necessary. In the current age, we have access to almost unlimited entertainment, so it's very easy to get caught up in all kinds of non-productive activities. With doing less, Marcus Aurelius also meant talking less. Many conversations are nonsensical, lead to nowhere, and only waste our time and energy. So doing less means doing the essential. And doing the essential not only means that we cut out the nonsense, but also that we work more intelligently and efficiently. A big advantage that we gain from this, besides tranquility, is that we can do less better. Doing the essential consistently takes a mindful approach. I quote, "If you can eliminate it, you'll have more time and more tranquility. Ask yourself at every moment, is this necessary?" But we need to eliminate unnecessary assumptions as well to eliminate the unnecessary actions that follow. End quote. A good habit that helps to stay focused on our daily endeavors is making a list of tasks the night before. This way, we premeditate on what we have to do when we get up in the morning, which has a calming effect on the mind. Because when we design our days beforehand, there's one less thing for the mind to worry about. 2. Short escapes. In another video, I've explained that the Stoics aren't too fond of traveling for recreational purposes and don't see it as a good way to seek tranquility. The reason for that is that wherever we go, we take ourselves with us, so the effects of traveling are only temporary. Thus, as soon as the novelty subsides, we'll be confronted with our own minds again. Marcus Aurelius was critical of people seeking refuge from daily worries by traveling or residing in quiet places like the mountains or beaches.
In his mind, this was an idiotic thing to do, because why should we travel when we can get away by going within? Nowhere you go is more peaceful, more free of interruptions than your own soul, he said. There's nothing wrong with changing scenery once in a while to facilitate our mental retreat, as long as we keep these escapes basic and brief. What Marcus Aurelius proposed reminds me a lot of meditation, or perhaps moments of reflection and contemplation in order to renew ourselves so we can calmly proceed our daily lives. He gave us two things to ponder over if we choose to briefly retreat in our minds. I quote, 1. That things have no hold on the soul. They stand there unmoving, outside it. Disturbance comes only from within, from our own perceptions. And 2. That everything you see will soon alter and cease to exist. Think of how many changes you have already seen. The world is nothing but change. Our life is only perception. End quote. Which brings us to the next piece of advice, which is remembering that all shall pass. The Stoics are infamous for remembering the frightening reality of life, that it's going to end. Memento mori means the remembrance of death, which is the ultimate acceptance that the changing nature of the universe also means the decay and vanishing of ourselves. Marcus Aurelius tells us to keep in mind how fast things pass us by. We can be immersed in something in one moment, and in the next moment it could be something totally different. Trends come and go in the blink of an eye, and when we look at the history of this planet, human life is just a tiny little hiccup in this cosmic evolution. The fact that everything is in flux could be a source of anxiety, because nothing is stable, and eventually we will be separated from our possessions and loved ones. But it can be a source of calm as well. The realization that everything is temporary means that there is no point in clinging to good times and being strongly averse to bad times. Happiness is a relative thing. Even in prison, there are good and bad days. And even millionaires experience joy and suffering. This means that our inner world, thus the way we perceive our life situation and how we react to that, is also in flux. Moreover, we can influence how we react to change. So why should destiny concern us so much? As Marcus Aurelius wrote, "The infinity of past and future gapes before us, a chasm whose depths we cannot see. So it would take an idiot to feel self-importance or distress, or any indignation either, as if the things that irritate us lasted." It's quite easy to offend someone these days. Even me stating this observation can rub someone up the wrong way. In the age of social media, we get bombarded with crude language, opinions we don't like, and stuff that's downright mean. That's probably why we see an increase in language policing and censorship. To some extent, depending on the context, this can be a good thing, for example, to protect minors. But when it's going too far, we can ask ourselves, aren't we getting too thin-skinned? From a Stoic point of view, we're not offended by what we deem offensive, but by our choice to be offended. Words of other people cannot hurt us unless we let them. Seneca the Younger was a statesman, dramatist, and satirist, but I think that most of us know him as one of the great Stoic philosophers. Seneca was concerned with the nature of insults and being offended. He wrote down his thoughts on this matter in a work named the Constantia Sapientis, which is Latin for On the Firmness of the Wise Man. He criticized his friend Serenus for wishing that people, in general, shouldn't offend each other. According to Seneca, this is completely unrealistic and not in our control. Instead, we should aim for not being offended, which is in our control. This brings us to the first piece of wisdom. Don't demand the world to be nice. The world is full of people that are selfish, insolent, arrogant, ignorant, mean, cruel, and so forth. This may sound pessimistic, but it isn't far from the truth. We cannot expect that people are nice to us all the time, because they aren't. Humans possess the full range of emotions, desires, and mind states, from angry to happy, from compassionate to sadistic. Also, there are as many opinions as there are people, including opinions we don't agree with. Resisting this is a recipe for disappointment and will lead us to get offended all the time by what's simply a product of nature. Demanding that the world doesn't offend us is futile because it's impossible to alter more than 7 billion people to our own liking. As Seneca stated, and I quote, "You are expressing a wish that the whole human race were inoffensive, which may hardly be. Moreover, those who would gain by such wrongs not being done are those who would do them, not he who could not suffer from them, even if they were done." End quote. Now, even though we cannot demand that everyone will always be nice to us, this doesn't mean that we should put up with people treating us badly. We can set boundaries and choose to not spend time, or at least limit our interactions, with people that don't respect us. But if we accept that people will be people, including their darker sides, we'll not only have a much easier time here on Earth, we will also give our fellow human beings the right to exist and speak their minds. 2. Accept the truth, reject nonsense. So in my book, I've made a proposition inspired by the work of Seneca on how to handle insults based on truthfulness. With this method, it is logically impossible to be offended. Before I continue, let's take a look at what Seneca had to say about handling insults, jokes, and other stuff that people may throw at us. I quote, "Someone has made a joke about the baldness of my head, the weakness of my eyes, the thinness of my legs, the shortness of my stature. What insult is there in telling me that which everyone sees?" End quote. Now, the approach is very simple. If someone offends you, ask yourself if the thing that you feel offended by is truth or nonsense. If it's truth, why be offended by the truth? Or as Seneca states, what insult is there in telling me that which everyone sees? If it's nonsense, why be offended by nonsense? If someone throws nonsense at us, isn't the person that does so the one we should feel ashamed instead of us? 3. Contemplate your ego. Seneca noticed that for some reason, people think that being insulted is one of the worst things that can happen. I quote, "Many think that there's nothing more bitter than insult. Thus you will find slaves who prefer to be flogged to being slapped, and who think stripes and death more endurable than insulting words." End quote. For your information, being slapped was a grave insult in the time that Seneca lived. He was a contemporary of Jesus Christ, so it's no surprise that the Bible speaks about showing the other cheek after being slapped. In this context, slapped doesn't mean physical assault, but rather an insult. When we are insulted, our ego is attacked. This is a consequence of the story we tell ourselves about ourselves and how the world should be. That's why we see that in different cultures and subcultures, people are offended by different things. When something conflicts our story, whatever that may be, this could lead to feeling offended. The questions we could ask ourselves are these. Why are we getting offended? What's the root of this? Is it because of something that happened in the past? Is it because of a certain ideology? Is it because I've been culturally conditioned to be offended by this? In my opinion, it shows much more character if we try and seek the root of our emotional reactions within ourselves instead of immediately finger-point at the outside world. Our own faculty is our own responsibility, and what other people think is none of our business.
We have 2 ears and 1 mouth, so we should listen more than we say. Zeno of Citium. Around 300 BC, Zeno of Citium founded the Stoic school of philosophy. He published a list of works on ethics, physics, logic, and other subjects, including his most famous work, Zeno's Republic, which does sound quite similar to a dialogue authored by a philosopher named Plato. Despite Zeno being the founder of Stoicism and having written extensively, he is hardly cited in modern Stoic literature. The reason for this is simple. None of his works have survived. The good news is that other authors wrote about him. Biographer Diogenes Laertius preserved most details about his life, including a series of fragments that give us an insight into what he taught. There's no certainty about Zeno's ethnic and cultural background,
except that his nickname was the Phoenician and that Diogenes described him as a haggard, dark-skinned man. His father gave him books about Socrates that he brought back from his travels as a merchant, and thus Zeno became obsessed with philosophy. He became a pupil of the famous Cynic Crates of Thebes, and among his other teachers were Polemo and Stilpo. Later in life, Zeno started teaching himself in the Stoa Poikile. His pupils were called Zenonians first, but later became known as the Stoics. Zeno was concerned with the whole spectrum of Stoic philosophy, like logic, epistemology, and the nature of the universe, which, according to his view, primarily consists of matter and is governed by a divine principle. God, therefore, isn't apart from the universe. It is the universe. This is a quote by Zeno that Roman philosopher Cicero preserved. "That which exercises reason is more excellent than that which does not exercise reason. There's nothing more excellent than the universe. Therefore, the universe exercises reason." End quote. Well, that's a hell of a statement to ponder over. It definitely lies at the basis of Stoic belief that the universe is governed by an intelligent and primordial matter called logos, which can also be called universal reason or fate. Living a life according to reason, therefore, is living a life in accordance with nature. This is the underlying idea of amor fati, which means the love of fate. In regards to ethics, Zeno's view seems compatible with the later Stoic definitions of them. Simply put, virtue is the only good, and as opposed to virtue, there is vice. The end goal is reaching a state of eudaimonia, which is human flourishing, and this can be achieved by the pursuit of virtue. Or as Zeno stated, happiness is a good flow of life. A bit more detailed description of eudaimonia we can find in the works of Diogenes, who quoted Zeno as follows. "The end may be defined as life in accordance with nature, or, in other words, in accordance with our own human nature, as well as that of the universe." End quote. Zeno also laid the foundation for the system of indifference. Things that aren't necessarily good or bad, but can nevertheless contribute to self-preservation or destruction. He saw the human tendency for self-preservation as a part of human nature, which isn't virtuous on its own, but could contribute towards one's efforts towards it. This sets the Stoics apart from the Cynics, who rejected possessions and everything that befalls the body. According to Stoicism, indifference do have value, and we should pursue them, but not cling to them as possessions that will make our life better, but as a catalyst for living in agreement with nature. For example, wealth itself doesn't lead to virtue, but it does lead to self-preservation, which can assist in the pursuit of virtue. Another example, sickness doesn't lead to vice, but it is not a preferable thing because its destructive nature goes against self-preservation. Zeno also stated that bad feelings are commotions of the mind, repugnant to reason and against nature. So even though emotions are human, they are a sign of, simply put, bad reasoning and could be overcome by getting a clear understanding of how life works. Grievance because of death could be overcome by accepting that death is a natural and inherent part of life, and our frustrations with bad parents could be overcome by the knowledge that, at the end of the day, no one is entitled to good parents. We see that all these misfortunes happen according to natural laws, which are, fundamentally, reasonable. About Zeno's death, there's no consensus, as different sources tell different things. Also, it is impossible to know what Zeno really thought, because none of his works survived. Some say that his contributions to Stoic philosophy, as we know it, were of high significance, while others believe that other philosophers like Cleanthes and Chrysippus were responsible for the actual development of Stoicism, and Zeno's role as founder is more of a symbolic one. Nonetheless, he remains a key figure in the history of Stoicism. Even though they followed the same philosophy, Marcus Aurelius was an emperor and Epictetus was a slave. The fact that someone from the lowest class became one of the greatest Stoic philosophers indicates that Stoicism isn't just for the elite, it's for everyone. part of Stoic philosophy is the ability to keep a calm mind. As a matter of fact, the Stoics believe that humans in a state of flourishing have attained true happiness, which always goes together with inner peace. The works of Epictetus reveal the importance of tranquility, and that we should value this over lesser things, like money, reputation, and even the body. He tells us that a calm mind is not achieved by trying to alter and control our surroundings. It's achieved by the way we think. The main work of Epictetus is called Discourses, a collection of lectures that were written down by a pupil named Arrian. This same pupil also compiled the Enchiridion, which means handbook, and is quite easy to read and digest. In these sources, we can discover how Epictetus thought about coping with daily worries, stressful events, and hardships, so we can keep a calm mind regardless of what the world throws at us. Let's start with the first one: act in accordance with nature. When Epictetus was teaching, one of his students told him that he wanted to go home because he was sick. Epictetus then sent him home, but also asked his student whether or not he thinks that with his condition he is able to improve his moral purpose, and thus, him coming to class was the right thing to do. He said, "Go back and tend your affairs at home, for if your governing principle cannot be brought into conformity with nature, no doubt your paltry piece of land can be made to conform with it." End quote. The lesson we take from this is that we should do what the current situation asks from us. Whatever overcomes us is the way of the universe. There's no need to force things. So when we are sick, we shouldn't force ourselves to do things we cannot do. In many cases, the best way to treat an illness is by accepting it and doing what's best for us in that given moment. Sure, Epictetus also stated that illness is a hindrance to the body, but not to our ability to choose, which doesn't mean that we should force ourselves to perform our duties, which might only make it worse. It means that despite the physical hindrance, we still can choose to panic or to make rational choices in a more tranquil fashion. When we look at a pandemic, for example, we see two extremes. On one end, there's panic. On the other end, there's this complete nonchalance. In the first case, people are overtaken by fear and emotion. And in the second case, people refuse to see the problem and perhaps try to make themselves look tough. But acting in accordance with nature, meaning the nature of the universe, as well as our human nature, starts by acknowledging the situation, doing proper research, and taking the necessary measures while keeping a cool head. No matter how we choose to react, it's important to remember that sickness and death are simply part of nature. We all go someday. Which brings us to the next one: watch your judgment. Anxiety isn't caused by the environment, it's caused by the position we take towards the environment. We all have our frames of reference, and from that frame, we decide what we tolerate and what we don't tolerate. There's nothing wrong with that. Oftentimes, it serves a purpose to discern right from wrong. However, our judgments become a problem if they make us feel entitled to things that we're naturally not entitled to. For example, we can be angry for a lifetime because we feel entitled to good parents we never had. But Epictetus points out that we are not entitled to a good parent, just to a parent. And this is true for many things. So why should we feel distressed by the things that are entirely natural? I quote, "Distinguish within your own mind and be prepared to say, it's not the accident that distresses this person, because it doesn't distress another person. It is the judgment which he makes about it." End quote. Again, this is important when we face illness or death. These things are nothing new. They are part of nature, as much as war and violence, and should rather be approached with equanimity than strong aversion. Moreover, when we don't carry strong desires and aversions, we're more capable of dealing with the situation in a rational way than when we are led by irrational thoughts and emotions. 3. Focus less on things outside of your control. At the beginning of the Enchiridion, we'll find the famous dichotomy of control, which is a cornerstone of Stoic thinking. It emphasizes that some things are up to us and others are not, and that we ought to focus on the former and have contempt of the latter. As living creatures in this universe, we have to deal with what's around us. We might desire to control the outside world, perhaps by money, a position of power, physical strength, intelligence, or intimidation. But at the end of the day, these are just instruments that can influence but never control. And even if we do manage to control some things, there's always a billion of other things that slip out of our hands. What we do control, according to Epictetus, is our own faculty, and that's what we should focus on. What happens around us isn't that important. It's more important what we do with it. Therefore, we can choose to focus our attention on our own thoughts and emotions, rather than constantly worrying about stuff we can't do much about anyway. This doesn't mean that we close ourselves off completely. It means that we develop a healthy indifference towards outside events, so that they won't stress us out too much. This is where amor fati, the love of fate, comes in. Because is there a better way to deal with the unavoidable than to embrace it? When a crisis is upon us, how can we deal with it in a stoic way? When we look at stoic literature, we'll find some good advice that we can apply during times of hardship. Crises come in many different forms. We can have personal crises on a micro level, but we can also be faced with a global crisis that hits us all. The nature of crisis is that we are temporarily in a different state, often characterized by danger and with an acute need of measures and solutions. Being in a crisis doesn't have to affect our behavior in a bad way. In fact, as opposed to what's happening around us, we're still in control of our own actions. This doesn't remove the fact that crises can be highly stressful and cause many to suffer. Marcus Aurelius endured many hardships during his reign as leader of the most powerful empire in the world. He faced war, but also the plague that broke out in the east, which eventually caused the death of 5 million Romans. Among the victims was Lucius Verus, who was not only Marcus Aurelius' adoptive brother, but also reigned with him as co-emperor. In his Meditations, a theme that Marcus Aurelius frequently writes about is the human connection between each other and nature. In a crisis that affects lots of people, the awareness of our connectedness is key when it comes to coping, supporting each other, and finding solutions. Hence the first one: working together, playing your part. As most of you know by now, Stoicism isn't about becoming an emotionless rock. It's about virtue, and part of virtue is acting for the benefit of the world and humanity. Marcus Aurelius emphasizes that we're interdependent, and therefore we're not supposed to be egotistical hermits that only think of themselves. It's appealing, I know, especially living in a free and individualistic society in which we can go our own ways. But when a crisis hits, we're again reminded of how much we rely on external factors, like technology and other people. The structures we are living in are threatened. And when the system fails us, we will be condemned to each other again on a more primitive level. Hence, in crises, it's particularly important to recognize our connection and set our egos aside to help a fellow human, and rely on our ability to forgive and tolerate, instead of solely engaging in selfish pursuits. As Marcus Aurelius wrote in his Meditations, we're born to work together like feet, hands, and eyes, like the two rows of teeth, upper and lower. To obstruct each other is unnatural. To feel anger at someone, to turn your back on him, these are obstructions. End quote. 2. Doing what you can, accepting what you can't. Now, when we deal with our fellow humans, we'll undoubtedly be confronted with people that are selfish, irrational, emotional, mean, violent, greedy, hostile, etc. Some people are in full panic mode and go overboard when it comes to taking measures to protect themselves. With their heightened survival instincts, their main focus is self-preservation. There's nothing wrong with self-preservation, of course, but when it becomes an obsession, it may damage those around us and only worsen the situation. This is especially true for those that see the crisis as an opportunity to screw people over and make some big bucks out of it. But it's essential to remember that we only control our own actions. We cannot control how people behave, and whether or not they flout the measures necessary to improve the situation. We cannot control various aspects of the crisis itself and how everything plays out. Therefore, we rely on our own thinking capacity to navigate ourselves through the crisis, regardless of how it unfolds. It's up to us how we act, and to act despite the actions of others is all we can do. 3. Adapting to the new situation. Whether we like it or not, times have changed, and during a crisis, we play by different rules. When we're stuck in our routines for so long and have taken our lifestyles and the comforts of society for granted, a crisis can be a very humbling experience. Things that seemed so normal and stable have suddenly become very uncertain. The economy takes a hit with all consequences. Necessary measures to fight the crisis lead to the disruption of our daily affairs. It shows us that we, despite our technological advancements, are still very vulnerable, and that our well-being isn't self-evident. Especially in times of turmoil, we're forced to do an appeal on our ability to adapt. To do this, it's essential to accept the changing nature of the universe, so we can let go of the past and the things we took for granted, and focus on the present and make the best out of it. I quote, "Change and flux constantly remake the world, just as the incessant progression of time remakes eternity. We find ourselves in a river. Which of the things around us should we value when none of them can offer a firm foothold? Like an attachment to a sparrow, we glimpse it and it's gone." End quote. Work together, do what you can, accept what you can't, and adapt. That's, in a nutshell, how we can be stoic in a crisis. Worse than war is the very fear of war. Seneca. Human history has never been free from adversity. Events like war, the outbreak of plagues, and natural disasters have caused dark times, tainted by suffering and death. Without a doubt, the ancient Stoics had their fair share of hardship, and the difficulties of life are the core of their philosophies. In hard times of great uncertainty, many people start worrying about their stable, comfortable lives falling apart, which is not only realistic, sometimes it's inevitable. The prospect of undergoing significant changes by the hands of misfortune, not knowing where this change leads to, can be nerve-wracking. The Stoics had some profound things to say about dealing with external circumstances and how to live peacefully in the face of hardship and a troubled future. Living in a society in which mass consumption is the norm and companies brainwash us into believing that we need their products to feel complete, the distinction between what we truly need and what's obsolete has become invisible. In wealthy countries, people rarely concern themselves with their basic needs, because these are a given. But when hard times are knocking on our door, it's time to create clarity, decide what our priorities are, and learn to deal with uncertainty. First of all, it's essential to remember the dichotomy of control, and to be constantly aware of the fact that we only control our own actions. According to Epictetus, things like our body, property, and reputation are not up to us. When the economy declines, for example, there isn't much we can do about it. We could lose a lot of money in the stock market, our jobs, and thus our income. But from a Stoic point of view, by tying our happiness to these things in the first place, we have already set ourselves up for disappointment. As Epictetus stated, and I quote, "The things in our control are by nature free, unrestrained, unhindered, but those not in our control are weak, slavish, restrained, belonging to others. Remember, then, that if you suppose that things which are slavish by nature are also free, and that what belongs to others is your own, then you will be hindered." End quote. Now, the Stoics make a distinction between virtue, vice, and indifference. Virtue and vice correspond with our own actions. For example, doing something for the benefit of the community, like providing food to the poor and elderly, can be considered virtuous. And trying to sell necessary goods for exorbitant prices can be considered a vice. But indifference are neither good or bad. Examples of these are wealth, health, disease, weakness, and poverty. In short, Indifference are external circumstances that are beyond our control. Now, why is this important? Well, what characterizes difficult times is that these indifferences are threatened, but not our ability to act. Does that mean that we shouldn't care about these external things at all? Not necessarily, as we need at least some of them to survive. However, when we are facing hard times, we might want to reconsider what we truly need. Basic needs like food and shelter, for example, so we can let go of the rest and stop worrying about them. On the verge of economic collapse, how important is it really to possess all kinds of luxurious goods? And to what extent does social status bring food to the table and protects us from an illness that doesn't discriminate between rich and poor? The more we are attached to these externals, the more we are disturbed by the prospect of losing them. Another essential Stoic lesson concerns death and suffering. This may sound blunt, but at the end of the day, death and suffering are part of nature. In the West, this is kind of taboo. Death is seen as something negative, something tragic, and needs to be avoided at all costs. And our comfortable lives minimize the amount of pain and suffering as much as possible. But in hard times, we might want to consider that no one is entitled to a long and healthy life. The history of our planet is a bloody one. Animals and humans kill each other every day. Children die at birth. And the Black Death killed half of Europe's population. Why should we, modern humans, have the right to be spared by the ways of nature? Memento mori means the remembrance of death. By reminding ourselves that death and suffering are inescapable and inherent parts of life, we might find some tranquility in the idea that the worst things that can happen to us are actually quite natural. Like Socrates, Seneca died peacefully. Moreover, he saw relief in death. I quote, "Death is a release from and an end of all pains. Beyond it, our sufferings cannot extend. It restores us to the peaceful rest in which we lay before we were born. If anyone pities the dead, he ought also to pity those who have not been born." End quote. A final piece of Stoic advice for finding a sense of calm in adversity is to remind ourselves that we do not control our destiny. We can influence the future by our actions in the present, but the results are so dependent on external circumstances that it's impossible to guarantee a certain outcome. The economy may fall apart, we may lose our jobs, mass poverty may kick in, and huge numbers of people may pass away, and no single worry can change that. So why don't we allow ourselves to just let go of the burden of the future, knowing that whatever happens, we are in full control of the most powerful weapon available, our own faculty. If we can cope with death, we can also cope with life. The good news is that everything is in flux and born out of change, like night and day, and fall and spring. So this too shall pass. History has shown us that people have endured the hardest of times, and that this experience often made them more humble, more humane, and more grateful for life. Thus, every outcome has its positive side, and regardless of what the future brings, no one takes away your power to make the best of it. How should we act when people around us are panicking, and how can we avoid panicking ourselves? Panic gets us nowhere, as it is a state of emotional turmoil during which our rationality is thrown overboard. So when we're faced with a wide variety of opinions, the strong language of influencers, and decisions based on fear and greed, it can be difficult to find direction and maintain course. But during times of mass hysteria, it's essential to use our capacity for rationality. From a Stoic point of view, our decisions should be based on facts and logic, and our actions have to be in the interest of the common good. In times of hardship, it's not an unnecessary exercise to fortify our minds with philosophical ideas, so we don't slip into the trap of panic. Roman emperor and Stoic philosopher Marcus Aurelius had some valuable insights on how to strengthen the mind so we don't deviate from the right path. Now, let's start with the second question, as it paves the way to answering the first one. How can we avoid panicking ourselves? To navigate our minds back into tranquility, it is important to become aware of the nature of what we are panicking about, and also the reasons why we panic. In his Meditations, Marcus Aurelius mentions that no matter what happens, it is something that has happened before. When we are ruled by the issues of the day, we lose sight of the bigger picture. So what unfolds in a moment may seem totally new and alien. In a way, this is true, because nothing that happens now takes place in the past. However, when we look at historical accounts, we see that they are filled with the same old, same old. Marcus Aurelius shifts the paradigm by pointing out that life is simply history repeating itself. So we could say that we experience the same archetypal storylines over and over again, just with different characters and in different formats. Lost all your money? Your job? Millions of people are going through the same thing as we speak, and have been in the past. Is the world ravaged by the plague? We had the Spanish flu, the Black Death, SARS, MERS. Humanity has gone through many different crises. Individual people have faced a lot of hardship in their lives. There have been good times and bad times, and we have gone through peace and war. History taught us that this mechanism never changes as long as we exist. It is simply life manifesting the same patterns. Everything is transient, like yin and yang. So why do we panic when it's just another manifestation of the same? Probably because the thing we panic about disguised itself as something unprecedented. It triggers our fear of the unknown, while in reality it has happened many times before. What's new and scary now will be old and familiar tomorrow. That's because we are adaptable creatures who can change along with the transient nature of the universe. So to keep a cool head when things around us start to change quickly, we might want to repeat the following quote by Marcus Aurelius. No matter what happens, keep this in mind. It's the same old thing from one end of the world to the other. It fills the history books, ancient and modern, and the cities, and the houses too. Nothing new at all. Familiar, transient. End quote. All comes down to seeing things as they are, as much as possible, and doing the right thing based on rationality and not based on fear. Thus, in a crisis, we ought to prepare, but not overdo it, especially when it undermines the community. Marcus Aurelius emphasizes repeatedly that we should work together and act conformably to our own nature and the nature of the whole. Or, as he puts it, to do what the community needs done. When we panic, we are often inclined to act unintelligently and in ways that only make things worse or overlook the things that actually need to be done. That's why it's essential to keep calm in the face of adversity, because if we don't, we can screw things up. In the case of a virus outbreak, for example, instead of trying to be the hero of the day, it's probably much better to simply stay at home. Also, we may want to keep in mind that the media are companies motivated by profit, so they recreate and inflate reality by constantly focusing on certain topics that attract attention. When we expose ourselves to the media all day, we become deluded, because we start to believe that there's nothing else going on in the world besides disaster. And this is not true. So instead, it's better to focus on our direct environment, something that we can actually influence, and see how we can do something beneficial. Thus, don't try to change the things you cannot change. Now, when it comes to dealing with panicking people, staying calm in the herd is much easier when our own faculties are strong. If we are determined and don't let ourselves be carried away by our irrational thoughts and emotions, we become towers of strength that are immune to all compulsion, like, for example, the cravings for toilet paper. Even when world leaders act irrationally and the things they say don't make any sense, or when hostility and violence dominate the streets and people scream bloody murder, Marcus Aurelius would probably advise us to not engage and to calmly do what the situation asks of us. I quote, "Let them scream whatever they want. Let animals dismember this soft flesh that covers you. How would any of that stop you from keeping your mind calm, reliably sizing up what's around you, and ready to make good use of whatever happens?" End quote. At the end of the day, what people around us are doing is not up to us. If they feel that panic is the answer, we can only change their minds if they are open to alternatives. But when they aren't, we'll only waste time trying. In such cases, we are better off preventing ourselves to go along with their panic, so we maintain our inner peace. I quote, "The tranquility that comes when you stop caring what they say, or think, or do, only what you do. Not to be distracted by their darkness,
to run straight for the finish line, unswerving."
There's a big difference between having fortitude and hiding away in a fortress. In the latter case, we physically separate ourselves through self-isolation. Oftentimes, this is an attempt to hide from the big, bad things in the world. It's not unlikely that serial self-isolators suffer from feelings of powerlessness, believing that what's happening outside is too much for them, as they lack the strength and skill to cope. Unfortunately, they miss out on many life experiences, simply because they do not want to face the malevolence of humankind. Now, there's another way to go about this. Instead of self-isolation, we could choose to strengthen our faculties, meaning that we become more resilient towards unpleasant people and situations, and don't let them stop us from living a good life. What exactly does fortitude mean? The definition of fortitude, according to online dictionary Merriam-Webster, is strength of mind that enables a person to encounter danger or bear pain or adversity with courage. Stoic fortitude, therefore, is the art of strengthening the mind with stoic principles, so we become less inclined to hide away in our fortresses and live life more fully. The Stoics were masters at approaching the world with logic and reason, showing us that many external things are actually unworthy of our attention. Other people's opinions aren't as important as we think, and a good reputation is just a commodity that brings us from point A to point B. According to the Stoics, we can't change the world, but we can change our mindset, and thus, the position we take towards the world. With the right mindset, we can overcome any adversity. Of course, this isn't easy. It takes a lot of practice. So, how can Stoic principles transform our mindset? First of all, we might have certain beliefs that evoke irritation in us, sometimes so much so that it becomes a difficult task to merely live. Thus, not life itself, but our beliefs about how life should and shouldn't be are the cause of our pain. The logic behind this is that we tie our happiness to certain expectations. So when these expectations repeatedly do not come to fruition because they don't align with an undeniable and inevitable reality, we suffer. An example of this we can find in a letter that Stoic philosopher Seneca wrote to his friend Serenus. Serenus wished that people wouldn't treat each other with rudeness and scorn, but Seneca explained to him that this is the wrong way to look at it. I quote, "You are expressing a wish that the whole human race were inoffensive, which may hardly be. Moreover, those who would gain by such wrongs not being done are those who would do them, not he who could not suffer them, even if they were done." End quote. Thus, by changing how we look at the world, we relieve ourselves from the pain of resistance. Life is full of pain, and full of people that are rude, selfish, and violent. The less we resist this fact, the more we can face the world in a tranquil manner. In his work of Peace of Mind, Seneca argued that we cannot live well if we don't know how to die well. If we know that death is the fate that was laid upon us the moment we were born, we will live according to it. This realization adds to our mental fortitude. Knowing that we could die any time, nothing can befall us unexpectedly. I quote, "For by looking forward to everything which can happen, as though it would happen to him, he takes the sting out of all evils, which can make no difference to those who expect it, and are prepared to meet it. Evil only comes hard upon those who have lived without giving it a thought, and whose attention has been exclusively directed to happiness. Disease, captivity, disaster, conflagration are none of them unexpected. I always knew with what disorderly company nature has associated me." End quote. We'll continue with Epictetus. Epictetus teaches us the foundation of mental fortitude, which is the curbing of our desires and aversions. Most people that go into the world desire certain outcomes. This isn't necessarily a bad thing, but such a stance has its consequences. I quote, "He who is making progress, having learned from philosophers that desire means the desire of good things, and aversion means aversion from bad things. Having learned too that happiness and tranquility are not attainable by man otherwise than by not failing to obtain what he desires and not falling into that which he would avoid. Such a man takes from himself desire altogether and defers it, but he employs his aversion only on things which are dependent on his will." End quote. This very much applies to everything we do. As Epictetus states in his work The Enchiridion, things beyond our control are weak and slavish, and if we let our mood depend on things that are not up to us, we find ourselves in quite a feeble position. Therefore, according to Epictetus, we should be indifferent towards anything independent of our own will, because if we aren't, we let external factors rule over our ability to be happy. Mental fortitude, therefore, entails a healthy contempt for the things beyond our control, things we normally approach with desire and aversion. This means ceasing to desire that people like you, ceasing to be averse to losing your possessions, and focusing entirely on your own actions. Epictetus goes as far as to say that we should even wish to be ridiculed, despised, and come off as losers if that preserves our peace of mind. I quote, "You must watch, you must labor, you must get the better of certain appetites, must quit your acquaintance, be despised by your servant, be laughed at by those you meet, come off worse than others in everything, in magistracies, in honors, in courts of judicature. When you have considered all these things round, approach, if you please, if by parting with them you have a mind to purchase equanimity, freedom, and tranquility." End quote. The next one is Chrysippus, who is often regarded the greatest of all Stoics. Chrysippus made great contributions to Stoic philosophy, particularly in regards to the Stoic system of propositional logic. He was quite an industrious man, having written more than 700 volumes. Unfortunately, none of them survived. Chrysippus further expanded on the Stoic system of ethics and followed the idea that living a happy life is the end goal which all of our actions should be geared towards. And to reach this goal, we should examine the universe to find out what's good and bad, or how we put it, to live in accordance with one's experience of the things which come about by nature. From this view, the Stoics gave birth to a system that differentiates between virtue, vice, and everything that's in between, and concluded that living virtuously means living happily, and living viciously means living unhappily. One of the cardinal Stoic virtues is courage, as opposed to cowardice, which the Stoics consider a vice. Courage can be considered an essential element of building Stoic fortitude. Oftentimes, the path of virtue requires us to face our fears and go through pain instead of avoiding it. Courage allows us to make the right choices and reach our goals despite the obstacles that lay on our path. Typical everyday vices are quick fixes, using substances immoderately or replacing challenging tasks by easily digestible pleasures are ways in which we cower away from difficult situations. The problem is that vices bring short-term pleasure that is immediately followed by the misery of not reaching our long-term goals or gambling away opportunities we're too afraid to take. And the inevitable low that follows from doing something that isn't good for us and our environment, which often manifests in shame and guilt. Virtue, on the other hand, may involve temporary discomfort, but the long-term satisfaction we gain is absolutely worth the struggle. Therefore, we could see virtue as a star in the sky that we continuously aim for. And by anchoring ourselves in a goal that transcends pain and pleasure, it's much easier not to falter in the face of adversity. This mindset requires an indifference towards the external situation we're in, not letting it overshadow our faculty of choice. Thus, we focus primarily on our own actions and whether or not they are virtuous. What's happening around us comes secondary, as it's a matter of fate, which is beyond our control. I quote, "If I knew that it was fated for me to be sick, I would even wish for it. For the foot also, if it had intelligence, would volunteer to get muddy." End quote. Sickness to the body, or whatever else may overcome us, doesn't impede our ability to act. According to the Stoics, what happens is how nature has intended it to be, so we shouldn't wish for things to happen differently. Instead, we should accept it and do what's best in that given situation. This accepting position towards fate and how this benefits fortitude brings us to the next Stoic philosopher and once emperor of Rome, Marcus Aurelius. As the leader of the world's largest empire, Marcus Aurelius knew exactly how harsh life can be. Rome was not only in continuous war with its enemies, it was also struck by the plague. And on top of that, Marcus suffered various illnesses and a betrayal by his wife Faustina. Also, to cope with all the difficult people he faced on a daily basis, he invented a Stoic exercise called the negative visualization that fortifies the mind by adjusting our expectations. In the 11th book of his Meditations, Marcus encourages himself to live virtuously, without being stopped by the people that stand in his way. Not everyone wants the best for us, and some try to sabotage us, but regardless of what they do, for our fault, as they are unable to affect our ability to choose. Thus, we are responsible for our own choices. I quote, "Someone despises me, that's their problem. Mine, not to do or say anything despicable. Someone hates me, their problem. Mine, to be patient and cheerful with everyone, including them. Ready to show them their mistake, not spitefully or to show off my own self-control, but in an honest, upright way." End quote. To summarize, Seneca advised us to let go of our ideals about how the world should be and instead take it how it is. Also, he told us that we cannot live well if we don't know how to die well. Thus, we shouldn't close our eyes for misfortune. Instead, we should expect it and see it as a part of life. Epictetus told us that the things beyond our control are weak and slavish, so they're unreliable factors to base our happiness upon. It's better to be indifferent towards anything independent of our own will. These things are inferior to what's truly in our power, our own actions. Chrysippus, the greatest of all Stoics, further developed the Stoic system of ethics, showing us that a happy life is a virtuous life. Courage is one of the cardinal virtues, meaning that we must be willing to endure discomfort and face our fears in order to live well. If we choose to engage in vices instead, we may experience short-term pleasure, but this will lead to unhappiness in the long run. Marcus Aurelius wrote in his Meditations that no matter how severe the external circumstances are, they won't impede our ability to choose. Therefore, we can't blame other people for our faults. We are responsible for our own choices. The less we care about the things that don't matter, the stronger our determination will be. In Greek philosophy, we can distinguish several human states of mind and being that can be acquired by correct philosophical understanding as well as the pursuit of virtue. The main goal of a Stoic is to live in accordance with nature. Such existence manifests itself in what the Stoics call eudaimonia, which is the flourishing of life. Integral parts of eudaimonia are ataraxia and apatheia. The latter is the term that the Stoics prefer. The different Hellenic philosophical schools didn't always agree on what the ultimate pursuit is and how to pursue it. We can see differences between Stoicism and, for example, Buddhism as well when it comes to enlightenment. While in Buddhism, nirvana is the freedom of suffering that is attained by walking the Eightfold Path, in Stoicism, it's a state of flourishing called eudaimonia. We can attain eudaimonia by living virtuously, and we can't have it without apatheia and ataraxia. I'll start with apatheia first.
In short, apatheia is the freedom of passions. It's not the same as apathy, which has kind of a negative connotation to it. It's not the same as indifference either. The best way to translate apatheia is equanimity. The Stoics distinguish four passions: lupe, phobos, epithumia, and hedone. Lupe means distress, which is an emotional reaction linked to a value judgment of something that's not in our control. For example, you've lost your job. You think losing a job is a bad thing, which can lead to even more bad things like poverty, a bad reputation, social isolation, etc. The thoughts about this event, not the event itself, cause distress. Phobos means fear. Fear leads to avoidance. A person who is afraid to talk to people, for example, will avoid social events. And when a person who fears spiders encounters a tarantula, an intense emotional reaction will follow. Epithumia means lust or cravings. We can lust after people, food, and even objects, which happens to people with fetishes. It's a strong desire for something external. This also means that the object of our desire has a certain power over us, and thus can manipulate our actions. We see this in relationships or marriages in which the act of sex is used as a tool to get things done. Hedone means delight. Delight is a bit more subtle than lust. It means that we take pleasure and enjoyment in things that happen, but in an irrational way. The problem with delight is that it can often lie at the basis of evil. For example, we can take delight in our neighbor's misfortune, and a sadist takes delight in someone's pain. But also the delight in food. If we realize that food has, essentially, the purpose of nutrition, is there anything virtuous about indulging in the pleasure of the tongue? Pursuing these kinds of irrational pleasures is not conformable to nature, according to the Stoics. The Stoics believe that the freedom of these unhelpful passions characterizes the eudaimonic state. Now, it's also possible to transform our shadow of unhealthy passions into healthy passions if we first acknowledge them in ourselves and see them as opportunities for change. Fear can be transformed into caution, which helps us to stay on the right path. Lust can be transformed into wishing, in this case, wishing the right things. Delight can be transformed into joy, enjoying virtue in others and ourselves. Now, the second one is ataraxia. Ataraxia is similar to apatheia, but there are differences. Ataraxia also refers to tranquility and equanimity. In this case, the freedom of worry and distress. The state of ataraxia is not a goal in Stoicism, but rather a byproduct of living in accordance with nature. The Epicureans, however, do have ataraxia as an end goal, since their philosophy revolves around moderately experiencing pleasure while avoiding pain. This avoidance of pain also means the avoidance of certain elements of life that cause distress, like political life. This is where the Stoics and the Epicureans don't agree on, because according to the Stoics, we should be useful for society, which includes, sometimes, taking the difficult position of a statesman. Instead of letting our peace of mind depend on external things, the Stoic seeks to flourish in pursuing virtue. Constantly practicing virtue produces ataraxia as a byproduct. Also, transforming bad passions into good passions will be followed by ataraxia. So a crucial difference between ataraxia and apatheia is that ataraxia was an end goal for the Epicureans, but not for the Stoics. The Stoics acknowledge this term, but prefer apatheia to describe a mind state similar to ataraxia. In Stoicism, both ataraxia and apatheia are seen as a byproduct of virtue. This takes us to the next term, eudaimonia. Eudaimonia is the ultimate state in Stoicism and equals life in accordance with nature. We could translate eudaimonia into happiness, but I don't think that's enough, because there are so many explanations of happiness that the term has become a bit vague. Living in accordance with nature is vague to most people as well. In short, with nature, the Stoics consider human nature as well as the nature of the whole when they formulated their philosophical system. The Cynics, for example, could be considered a bit extreme, and they have little regard for the notion that humans are naturally inclined to pursue things that aren't necessarily bad, like wealth, friendship, and intimacy. So a Stoic would say that abstaining from things like food or shelter is not the path to happiness and does not equal virtue per se. They actually sought to unify human nature with philosophy so that the one wouldn't block the path of the other. When we look at Stoic virtue, we can see that virtue and vice are independent of one's, for example, financial state. Virtue can be subdivided into moderation, courage, justice, and wisdom. Vice can be subdivided into intemperance, cowardice, injustice, and foolishness. Instead of deliberately seeking peace and quiet, or trying to get rid of unhealthy passions, the Stoics propose to follow virtue and avoid vice. Simply put, eudaimonia is the goal, and ataraxia and apatheia will come naturally when achieving that goal. Eudaimonia isn't just a feeling of bliss, it's the morally virtuous engagement with society and life in general, in ways that benefit all. The ability to do this does not depend on external factors, like how much money or friends you have, or sickness or health. So it can be achieved by anyone who is willing to improve. People spend so much energy on worrying about what other people think about them. The thing is, it's a huge waste of time, especially in the age of the individual. The ancient Stoics were ahead of time when it comes to the art of not caring about how others perceive them. It's very easy to get caught up in this ongoing collective worry about what other people think and say about us, even if we don't know them. Marcus Aurelius was right when he said that we care more about their opinions than our own. But why do we do this? Well, our desire to be liked probably comes from a deeply rooted fear of being abandoned. In the tribal age, abandonment could easily mean death. So being liked was useful for survival. We can see this in animals as well. Dogs, for example, are herd animals and dread to be left alone, so they cry and moan when their owner leaves the house. But when we look at this in a logical way, there's no need to fear abandonment, and in most cases, our lives aren't in danger when other people don't like us or disapprove of us. Yes, it may be more preferable when we are loved by our surroundings, but we don't need it for survival, and we don't need it to be happy. As the Stoics would say, a good reputation is a preferred indifferent. It's nice to have, but if we don't, it doesn't exclude virtuous living. In other words, if we live virtuously, why should we care what others think? We know we live in a good way, and that's what counts. Wasn't Jesus Christ despised by the masses, despite the fact that he embodied the good? Roman emperor and Stoic philosopher Marcus Aurelius wrote about this contempt for validation-seeking behavior. And I quote, "What is to be prized? An audience clapping? No. No more than the clacking of their tongues, which is all that public praise amounts to, a clacking of tongues." End quote. When we look at the very nature of receiving validation, from a physical audience clapping to likes on Facebook, what do we see? It's really nothing more than a few bodily movements and some pixels on the screen that give us a temporary rush of pleasure. However, validation never gives us long-term contentment and also leads to a craving for more. Thus, it's pretty useless to spend our lives chasing it. Nevertheless, we often see that people get upset when they don't receive the validation they think they deserve, or when they find out that someone dislikes them or even hates them. In some cases, a simple and meaningless insult leads to violence. The Stoics pointed out long ago that we do not control the opinions of others, and that the things we do not control are fickle. The more we value things outside our control, the less control we have. Let's face it, no matter how much we try, there will always be people that don't like us. There will always be people that are ungrateful, hostile, hateful, mean, etc. We often become resentful towards these people, and sometimes we spend a lifetime thinking about the nasty things they said. Here's what Stoic philosopher Epictetus said about this, and I quote, "When another blames you or hates you, or when men say anything injurious about you, approach their poor souls, penetrate within, and see what kind of men they are. You will discover that there's no reason to be concerned that these men have this or that opinion about you." End quote.
Resentment is like drinking poison and waiting for the other person to die. It's a complete waste of time. With a little bit of compassion, we'll see that those who offend us are human beings too. There are many possible reasons why they think what they think and say what they say. It may be ignorance, bias, frustration, or they might be pointing out something that's truly deficient about us. If the latter is the case, we have the option to fix it or let it be. No matter what we do, ruminating about someone else's dislike towards us won't get us anywhere. So it may not be up to us what other people think. It's definitely up to us how we handle it. Our ability to take position towards the external world is what makes us happy or not. Being hurt by other people's opinions isn't caused by them. It's caused by our minds worrying about things that are outside us and irrelevant for our own mental well-being. Simply put, what other people think is none of our business. You might be wondering, how did the ancient Stoics view lust and love? Were they hopeless romantics, or rather cold and distant? Were they pleasure seekers enjoying polyamory, or did they value the duties of marriage? So there's a big difference between love and lust, although in today's day and age we often mix them up. We could say that unconditional love is the purest form there is, and something that's completely in our control. Stoic philosopher Epictetus described the things in our control as by nature free, unrestrained, and unhindered. That's why we can give this type of love away freely and don't need anything in return. So the quality of it doesn't depend on what outside forces are up to. Lust, on the other hand, is a desire for something that is not in our control. When we are lustful, we crave for the body of another human being, and when this body, for some reason, isn't available, we suffer. Epictetus described the things not in our control as weak, slavish, restrained, and belonging to others. Living in a Western culture, I see great emphasis put on romantic love. The romantic love ideal has become such an important pursuit that we have elevated it to an ultimate concern. More often than not, in secular countries, romantic love rises above any form of religion and spirituality. Some people live for romance, making this mesmerizing experience the focus of their lives. Unfortunately, there's a problem with this pursuit. When two people fall in love, they reside in a period of infatuation called the honeymoon phase. Whether or not nature meant this to be simply an incentive to procreate, the honeymoon phase doesn't last. After the intense euphoria decreases, it's not unlikely that people feel cheated. Without the rose-colored glasses, they see a human being with, probably, the many flaws that they initially overlooked. As a result, many people rather seek for another romantic high and abandon those that aren't doing it for them anymore. Such a love is self-serving rather than serving others. In many ways, romantic love is built on clinging and aversion. We cling to someone immensely and are averse to the idea that we get separated from this person. He who fails to obtain the object of his desire is disappointed, and he who incurs the object of his aversion, wretched, said Epictetus. The experience of being wretched is very commonly seen in individuals that are in a romantic love affair, in the form of jealousy. Jealousy between lovers can be quite destructive. It's a fear-based emotion that our lover will leave us for another lover. This often results in possessiveness, the need to control the movement of another human being to assure ourselves that they won't do things we don't like, which is just another form of clinging. Such relationships don't seem very virtuous, nor do they lead to inner peace. Still, as opposed to what some might think, the Stoics did not disapprove of relationships. Yet they did not recommend clinging or the indulgence in lust. Seneca, for example, saw the indulgence in lust as worst of the sins, and I quote, "Among the worst cases I count also those who give their time to nothing but drink and lust, for these are the most shameful preoccupations of all." End quote. Seneca stated that those who are abandoned to the belly and lust bear the stain of dishonor, and thought that people who are quickly angered, greedy, and violent at least sin in a more quote-unquote manly fashion. This doesn't mean that we shouldn't experience lust at all. The joy of intercourse can be seen as a preferred indifferent, which is a subordinate to the Stoic virtue called moderation, as opposed to lustful indulgence. Seneca respected love and meaningful relationships with other people. In fact, they concerned him a great deal. He valued marriage and the duties involved and expressed his dislike towards divorce and adultery. Such a stance is congruent with Stoic ethics that point to living a virtuous life above everything else. Stoic philosopher Musonius Rufus also valued marriage a lot and saw mutual care as the cornerstone for a successful union. I quote, "In marriage there must be complete companionship and concern for each other on the part of both husband and wife, in health and in sickness, and at all times, because they entered upon the marriage for this reason, as well as to produce offspring." End quote. Musonius also observed that when in a marriage people only look at their own interests and neglect their partners, it is doomed to fail. We can see this happening in some affectionless marriages, in which people share a roof together while perpetually seeking pleasure outside the house. Musonius called this an existence worse than loneliness. Even though the Stoics considered love to be important, they also recommend us not to cling to the things we love. At the end of the day, a spouse, a friend, a child, or a pet is not in our control, and we can lose them in a heartbeat. Epictetus put it this way, and I quote, "Never say of anything, I have lost it, but I have returned it. Is your child dead? It is returned. Is your wife dead? She is returned." End quote. This attitude might come in handy for people that worry about their partners cheating in the future. If that happens, remember that this isn't a loss. It's just a return. To keep things simple, I would say that the core of Stoic love is the facilitation of virtue. A union between two people, like marriage, can be seen as a potential vessel for good, like caring for each other and raising children. This idea echoes through religions like Christianity and Islam, in which marriage is also seen as the correct way for two people to practice love as well as lust. Although the Stoics are not cold and distant towards human affection, they value virtue the most. Intimate relationships and virtue do not have to contradict each other. Even lust can be part of a virtuous life, as long as it isn't overdone. But hey, let's face it, aren't there higher things to pursue than some fun between the sheets? The ancient Stoics argued that living a virtuous life means living in accordance with nature. Now, what did they exactly mean by this? Are we to follow our instincts like animals do? Or perhaps should we live a nature-friendly lifestyle? The early Stoic Zeno of Citium was the founder of the Stoic philosophical school. Unfortunately, not much is left of his legacy, except a series of quotations. The Byzantine scholar Johannes Stobaeus, who lived in the 5th century, compiled a series of valuable extracts from Greek authors, in which he wrote about Stoic ethics and the way Zeno proposed them. Simply put, everything that is part of being consists of things that are good, bad, or indifferent. So this is what Stobaeus told us, and I quote, "Good are the following sorts of item: wisdom, moderation, justice, courage, and all that is virtue or participates in virtue. Bad are the following sorts of item: folly, intemperance, injustice, cowardice, and all that is vice or participates in vice." End quote. Now, the so-called indifference are either preferred or dispreferred, but do not necessarily lead to happiness or misery. Examples of these are death, looks, money, reputation, and so forth. The Stoics saw living in accordance with nature as the ultimate goal and equivalent to a virtuous life. Since virtue leads to happiness, people who live in conflict with nature are not happy. This is all great, but it's still a bit unclear how we actually put this into practice. What do the Stoics mean with nature, and how do we as human beings live in agreement with it? Well, there are different explanations. And since the accounts of the early Stoics are gone for the most part, we have to look at other authors to clear this up. Diogenes Laertius, a biographer of Greek philosophers, pointed out that with nature, the Stoics meant the nature of all things, also called the nature of the whole, and human nature as a part of this whole. He sums it up like this, and I quote, "Therefore, the end turns out to be living in agreement with nature, taken as living in accordance both with one's own nature and with the nature of the whole." End quote. When we look at our planet, we see that everything has its own characteristics. Water, for example, flows to the lowest point, nourishes whatever it encounters along the way, but in itself doesn't really have a thinking capacity. Nevertheless, water is part of a system, and I think that we can agree that it performs its duties quite well. Now, plants have their place too in nature. They produce oxygen, for example, or serve as food for animals. These animals, in their turn, can serve as food for other animals, as well as for human beings. The Stoics observed that human beings are, like animals, naturally inclined to self-preservation. That arises from what Zeno called okeiosis. Okeiosis signifies self-ownership, or the appropriation to the individual's or species' needs. We hoard resources, protect ourselves and loved ones, take care of our bodies, find shelter, etc. But what distinguishes us from animals is our rational thinking capacity. This is a huge game changer. An example: humans as well as animals have a natural tendency to be hostile towards the unknown, because it could be a threat. In humans, we can often see hostility towards people from another country, with different facial features, a different skin color, a different language, and so on. Even though we might experience an urge to be hostile towards the unknown, we also have a choice to approach the urge rationally and decide if we should act upon it or not. In the same way, we approach sexual desire or the sudden wish to kill our boss after he snaps at us for no reason. Animals can't rationalize their natural urges, so we can't really blame them for acting upon them all the time. But for humans, it's quite another story. We surely can rationalize our natural urges and choose to do what's right, whatever that may be, instead of letting instincts dictate us. So, how can we do this? Well, Marcus Aurelius was very clear about that, and I quote, "Human life, duration, momentary, nature, changeable, perception, dim, condition of body, decaying, soul, spinning around, fortune, unpredictable, lasting fame, uncertain. Sum up, the body and its part are a river, the soul a dream and mist. Life is warfare and a journey far from home. Lasting reputation is oblivion. Then what can guide us? Only philosophy." End quote. The Roman emperor wrote quite a lot in his Meditations about living in agreement with nature, and that we should always seek to define what our nature is and how it fits best within the bigger picture. So, who are we? Who am I? How do I relate to the world? When we look at humanity, it's clear that we all have our strengths and weaknesses, all have certain qualities. Some are better with their hands, some are better with their brains. We could therefore say that we are not created equal, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a way for everyone to be valuable to the whole. Also, this means that all people have access to a happy life, no matter what hardships they face and how bad the hand is they are dealt. So living in accordance with nature is not just living a virtuous life, but also living a life that suits you best as the human being you are. As Marcus Aurelius stated, "Don't ever forget these things. The nature of the world, my nature, how I relate to the world, what proportion of it I make up, that you are part of nature and no one can prevent you from speaking and acting in harmony with it, always." End quote. When we have something we cherish, like a spouse or a friend, or a certain status within a group, but we feel threatened of losing it, we experience resentment, which we call jealousy. So how can we deal with this? To begin, I first need to explain the difference between jealousy and envy. Jealousy comes from a fear of losing something to another person and is very common in intimate relationships, in which we fear to lose a partner to someone else. Envy is wanting something that someone else has, like a car, a house, looks, etc. Thus, envy is being resentful of people that are, in our eyes, more fortunate than ourselves. When I look at jealousy from a Stoic point of view, I see two things: the illusion of permanence and the belief that external things will make us happy. Now, the Stoics noticed that the nature of the universe is impermanence and that everything outside our faculty is not in our control. When you're jealous, you don't want to lose something external that you attach yourself to in this moment. The truth is, however, no matter how infatuated you currently are with your boyfriend or girlfriend, someday you will be separated. Bear in mind that everything that exists is already fraying at the edges and in transition, subject to fragmentation and to rot, is a quote by Marcus Aurelius. Everything is subjected to continual change. We could say that change is the only constant. When we fear and resist change, we become insecure, and insecurity is where jealousy is coming from. But we simply don't know how this change is going to manifest, so why worry about it? The only thing we can do is what's best in the moment we're in, without deriving rights from our actions in regards to the future. This is called amor fati, which means embracing the outcome, whatever it is. Epictetus has a powerful quote that relieves the pain of jealousy by reminding us that we never own what we are attached to, and that the presence of this particular person in our lives is temporary. I quote, "Never say of anything, 'I have lost it,' but 'I have returned it.' Is your child dead? It is returned. Is your wife dead? She is returned. Is your estate taken away? Well, and is not that likewise returned? But he who took it away is a bad man. What difference is it to you who the giver assigns to take it back, while he gives it to you to possess? Take care of it, but don't view it as your own, just as travelers view a hotel." End quote. No matter how much effort we put in our relationships, how well our property is secured, how great our reputation is, we can still lose the things we are attached to, like our spouse, our house, or our social status at the blink of an eye. This means that the fear we are experiencing when we are jealous is actually quite a rational one that aligns with the nature of the universe. Yes, your spouse may cheat on you with a coworker tomorrow. Yes, your supposed best friend may prefer the presence of someone else over your presence. The fact that these possibilities are realistic and common is a reason not to worry about it. Why are you trying to control the external world? That's not up to you anyway. It's a waste of time. "But I need this person to be happy," you might say. No, you don't. Within the Stoic system of ethics, all external things, including the people you love, are considered so-called preferred indifference. It's nice to have them, and they might support you in living a virtuous life, but preferred indifference are no hard requirement to be happy. According to the Stoics, happiness is found in virtuous actions. Here's a quote from Seneca. "Virtue is free, inviolable, not to be moved, not to be shaken, and so hardened against misfortunes that she cannot be bent, let alone overcome by them." End quote. From my understanding of Stoicism, my suggestion would be replacing the focus on the external with focus on the internal. Thus, stop obsessing about losing the things you love, because you'll lose them anyway, and they aren't as vital for your happiness as you may believe. Instead, you might want to focus on living well, regardless of what happens around you. And paradoxically, when you focus on living well, instead of anxiously grasping and clinging to the things you don't want to lose, you might actually attract more preferred indifference into your life. Also, the ones you already have are more likely to stick with you out of free will, as opposed to you being jealous, which will only drive them away. As a sequel to my video about jealousy, let's talk about envy. What is envy? How should we handle it? What can we learn from the Stoics in regards to envy? And is it really a bad thing?
I've previously discussed jealousy and proposed several solutions based on the works by Stoic philosophers Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius, and Seneca. There's a difference between jealousy and envy. The first one comes from a fear of losing something or someone to another person. The second one is the desire for something that belongs to someone else, like a car, a house, looks, and social status. In a general sense, I would go along with the consensus that envy isn't a good thing. But it's a bit more complicated. If we narrow it down, we see that envy is a form of desire, specifically focused on things that belong to other people. Desire means that we want to reach out for something that we consider as desirable, thus as something we want for ourselves. When the thing we are envious of is something external, like someone else's money, partner, car, job, etc., we desire pleasure rather than happiness. The focus of our envy is directed towards what the Stoics call preferred indifference, which are nice to have, but not necessary for happiness. Moreover, external things are not in our control. They could be taken away in a heartbeat, which makes them unreliable and weak. When we're envious about something internal, like the virtuous actions of someone else and their inner peace and happiness, it might be a sign that we have work to do on ourselves. Needless to say, the Stoics would encourage the desire of being virtuous. Paradoxically, when we pursue virtue and strengthen our own faculties, we are likely to get rid of envy altogether. As Epictetus stated, "We may be unconquerable if you enter into no combat in which it is not in your own control to conquer. When, therefore, you see anyone eminent in honors, or power, or in high esteem, or any other account, take heed not to be hurried away with the appearance, and to pronounce him happy. For if the essence of good consists in things in your own control, there will be no room for envy or emulation." End quote. Unfortunately, some people cling to envy so much that they engage in immoral behavior like stealing, infidelity, and even murder. In the Old Testament and the Quran, we find a story about a rivalry between the brothers Cain and Abel, sons of Adam and Eve. Cain was a farmer and Abel was a shepherd. Cain offered God a part of his crops, while Abel offered God the firstlings of his flock. Cain killed his brother after God accepted Abel's offerings, while he rejected his. The ancient scriptures don't explicitly mention envy, but interpretations of this story magnify the theme of envious rivalry between siblings, which is quite common to this day. However, the ancient scriptures don't mention why God did this. Was he capricious and treated Cain and Abel differently for no reason? This could be the case. Another possibility is that Abel acted more virtuously by giving God the best of his flock, as well as a blood offering, while Cain's offerings were of lesser quality. Interestingly enough, both scenarios are great starting points to look at envy from a Stoic point of view and use them as a metaphor for dealing with envy in our daily lives. The first scenario is that Abel indeed acted more in a virtuous way and was, therefore, rewarded by God. In this case, we can see the blood offering by Abel as a metaphor for what the Stoics would call an act of virtue. According to the Stoics, virtue leads to eudaimonia, which can be translated as human flourishing, or simply happiness. Thus, we could say that Cain was envious of Abel's virtue and the consequences of that virtue. This doesn't make envy a bad thing, at least not yet. The problem is that many envious people seek to destroy what they're envious of, instead of using envy to lift themselves up. So instead of killing his brother, Cain could have used the spark of envy to realize that Abel was doing a better job than him, and see his brother as an inspiration for becoming more virtuous himself. The second scenario is that God denied Cain's offerings for no reason, which basically resembles the way of the universe that are quite random and unfair. Some people are born in rich families, others in poverty. Some people are gifted with great intelligence, others are mentally disabled. This unfairness could have angered Cain so much that he decided to act out. If Seneca was around at the time, he could have told Cain that the unfairness of life doesn't influence the ability to be happy. I quote, "Come now,
Contrast a good man who is rolling in wealth with a man who has nothing, except that in himself he has all things. They will be equally good, though they experience unequal fortune. This same standard, as I have remarked, is to be applied to things as well as to men. Virtue is just as praiseworthy if it dwells in a sound and free body, as in one which is sickly or in bondage. End quote. So, is envy a bad thing? It really depends on what we are envious of and how we handle it. For the most part, being envious because of externals is kind of pointless. They're surely nice to have, but they won't obstruct the ability to be happy. On the other hand, we can use envy as a tool to better ourselves. Although the Stoics aren't very fond of pursuing material wealth, it's still possible to use envy as an inspiration to achieve this, if that's what you want. The dark side of envy is that it can also be an incentive to destroy the thing or person we are envious of. In this case, clinging to envy is a very dangerous thing. Personally, I think the best way to treat envy is by awareness. Why am I envious? Is my envy justified? In other words, does the thing I desire truly lead to happiness? Can I use my envy to better myself and subsequently get rid of envy? No matter if you look at Buddhism, Stoicism, or Christianity, the rule of thumb is, if we just focus on our own path and be grateful for what we have, there's no reason to be envious of anything. The Stoics bring forth the theme of self-control on a regular basis. Epictetus, for example, spoke about abstaining from talking about vulgar things. And Marcus Aurelius points out that we should set limits to comfort and consumption. When we make the distinction between the things in our control and not in our control, the key is strengthening the things in our control, which is, in one word, our own faculty. A strong faculty ensures that we are less likely to be enslaved by outside forces that are not up to us. This means that impulses, triggers, and temptations have less power over us, which strengthens our position in a universe that's ever-changing. This really hit me after I recently did a 72-hour water fast, during which I didn't eat and drank only water for 72 hours. The first day was most difficult, but the second day was surprisingly blissful, and I was able to do all tasks that I would normally do. This really changed my perception in regards to food. I used to think that I would faint if I didn't eat for a day, but it turns out that I'm doing fine after a period of not eating. The lesson I got from this is that many needs and desires come not so much from the body, but from certain ideas that are ingrained in our minds. For me, abstaining from food for 72 hours changed my relationship with it. I've become less needy, knowing that I'll be fine and that I'm perfectly able to function when I don't eat for a while. The consequence? I worry less about food. Statesman and Stoic philosopher Seneca reflected on the festivities going on in the city, during which the Romans feasted, got drunk, and basically indulged in pleasure. He argued that it's courageous to not participate in these festivities, but it's even more courageous to participate, but in a different way, without extravagance, thus, I assume, in a sober and modest fashion. To detach ourselves from luxury and test the constancy of the mind, Seneca gave us the following advice. Set aside a certain number of days, during which you shall be content with the scantiest and cheapest fare, with coarse and rough dress, saying to yourself the while, is this the condition that I feared? End quote. Emperor Marcus Aurelius wrote that we should set limits on leisure time, emphasizing that we aren't made to spend our lives eating, drinking, and sleeping to excess, especially when we look at the rest of the planet. I quote, "Don't you see the plants, the birds, the ants, and spiders, and bees going about their individual tasks, putting the world in order as best they can? And you're not willing to do your job as a human being? Why aren't you running to do what your nature demands?" End quote. Although I like his analogy, I must add that some animals probably aren't the best examples when it comes to industriousness. However, another argument that Marcus Aurelius brings forward repeatedly is that we should live in agreement with nature. More specifically, our human nature. The guideline for this are the Stoic ethics. To put it simply, if one lives virtuously, one lives in agreement with nature, and vice versa. Courage and moderation are two of the four cardinal virtues in Stoicism. Courage is subdivided into confidence, endurance, cheerfulness, high-mindedness, and industriousness. Moderation can be subdivided into modesty, seemliness, good discipline, and self-control. There are many ways to train self-control. Different types of fasting are very effective, but please consult your doctor first. Another way is restricting the usage of the smartphone, social media, and the internet altogether. Waiting a moment in front of your dish before you start to eat and chewing on your food for a certain amount of times before swallowing. You'll be amazed how difficult this is. Self-control makes us familiar with the hardship that many fellow human beings go through every day, like hunger, bad luck, and working insane hours with no vacation. Becoming more content with what we have and less dependent on what we think we need brings about a sense of inner peace and happiness. As Seneca puts it, "Let us become intimate with poverty, so that fortune may not catch us off guard. We shall be rich with all the more comfort if we once learn how far poverty is from being a burden." Thinking about death not only reminds us that we have a limited amount of time to do the things we want to do, it also teaches us to accept the reality of death itself and that it's all around us. Memento mori is Latin for "remember thou art mortal." On the famous painting by Philippe de Champagne from 1671, you see the three essentials of memento mori. The hourglass stands for the notion that life is ticking away second after second. The rose stands for the truth about vitality, which is that, at some point, we all decay. The skull represents death. We are going to die. And not only us, the people around us, including our loved ones as well. This means that today could be the last day you walk the earth. You could leave life right now. Let that determine what you do and say and think, wrote Marcus Aurelius in his Meditations. So if you would die today, what would you do? Well, some people would certainly go on a hedonistic binge, getting whatever pleasure they can think of before they die. But if you lead your life according to Stoic principles, that would not be a preferred option. Rather, you would probably live your last hours as virtuously as possible. Do you want to show appreciation for your loved ones? Tell them you love them. Do you have unfinished business? Now is the time to take care of that. So, memento mori is a great antidote to one of the nastiest habits of mankind: procrastination. Because procrastination can only take place if we believe that we have an abundance of time. When we take that belief away, we face the necessity of doing our task now, because tomorrow we might be dead. Now, thinking about death may evoke feelings of fear and sorrow, along with the motivation we get to take care of our business. This isn't caused by death itself, but by our opinions about death. Here's a quote by Epictetus. "Men are disturbed, not by things, but by the principles and notions which they form concerning things. Death, for instance, is not terrible, else it would have appeared so to Socrates. But the terror consists in our notion of death, that it is terrible." End quote. When we stop fearing death, and we see it as nothing more than the insurmountable consequence of life, we can be appreciative for the time that is given to us and not squander it doing petty things. Another dimension of memento mori is preparation. Yes, we will lose the people we love, and sometimes in the most brutal ways. Just look at human history, or look at what's happening in the world right now. The world is full of death. Not being affected by loss is, of course, easier said than done. Even though the Stoics proposed this ideal, most of us are still human and will have to deal with grief when someone they love dies. Now, reminding ourselves of the possibility that we can lose a loved one as we speak helps us to be less shocked when that happens. For most people I know, losing someone they love is excruciating.
humans are often so attached to each other that they cannot bear the loss. But if we are mindful of the truth of death, we can cultivate a healthier mindset towards the possibility of loss. Instead of clinging to a person, wishing that we will never get separated, we can embrace the reality that the day of separation will come. This doesn't mean that we shouldn't grieve and mourn. It means that we were prepared all along. We can be more functional and helpful human beings for the community when death occurs. In this case, losing someone due to mortality becomes more neutral. Here's how Marcus Aurelius puts it. Don't look down on death, but welcome it. It too is one of the things required by nature, like youth and old age, like growth and maturity, like a new set of teeth, a beard, the first gray hair, like sex and pregnancy and childbirth, like all the other physical changes at each stage of life. Our dissolution is no different. End quote. What happens after we die? Will we enter the eternal nothingness that frees us of sense perception, emotional turmoil, worry and rumination, and the enslavement of our bodies? Or will we return to the flesh again for another life in the realm of matter? No one knows for sure, but what we do know is that mortality is upon us. When death smiles at us, no matter where we go, is there a better response than to smile back?
A breakup can be excruciatingly painful. The concept of love and romance has changed over the centuries. Back in ancient Greece, I doubt there was a dating culture similar to what we have now. Nonetheless, I think we can bring everything down to certain human core emotions like lust, craving, attachment, or anger that haven't changed. Unlike humans, nature has all the time in the world. So even though civilization makes leaps and leaps forward, our physiology isn't very different from what it was like 2500 years ago. That's why an ancient philosophy like Stoicism is still applicable. Yes, we know much more now about how the brain works, but that doesn't take away the validity of Stoic wisdom. Now, that said, it's essential to deconstruct what's exactly happening when we break up and why we feel so bad. Now, falling in love is a very intense experience. Our bodies produce chemicals that make us feel good, and at some point, the only person we can think about is the one we're in love with. So I think that for a great part, it's a chemical thing, with the purpose of bonding and reproduction. That's why after the so-called honeymoon phase, these intense feelings begin to wane, until we stop seeing the other person through rose-colored glasses. So it's a temporary high. After the high is gone, there's often still a deep attachment. Is this attachment wrong in itself? At some point, we can't really help it, right? If it's there, it's there. But can we change the way we approach this attachment and this situation in which we are separated from the person we're attached to? This is where the power of the rational mind comes in, which the Stoics are masters at. Even though we can't just make the pain magically go away, what helps is changing certain wrong beliefs in order to accept the reality of the breakup and find a sense of peace in it. I would like to briefly discuss a few of these beliefs and what the Stoics say about them. 1. I need that person to be happy. This attachment can manifest itself in clingy behavior and the belief that we need this particular person to be happy. The common answer to this problem is that there's plenty of fish in the sea. This is of course true, which is already a reason why it's insane to think that there's only one person for you. But this doesn't really solve the problem, because no matter if there's 1, 10, or a billion fish in the sea, the fish is still something external. So theoretically, it's still possible that we can't obtain any of these fish, even if there's plenty of them. It's beyond our control. If we suffer from a breakup because we believe that we need the other person to be happy, we make the mistake of thinking that our happiness depends on something external. This is where Stoicism firmly disagrees with. According to Stoic philosophy, virtue is the only thing we need to be happy. Moreover, living a virtuous life is completely in our control. Romance, a relationship, marriage, and even having a family are all unnecessary for happiness, and they're also unreliable factors. The Stoics call these preferred indifference. preferred indifference are nice to have, but not mandatory for living a happy life. 2. I'm entitled to that person. Now, this is a belief or idea that evokes a lot of anger in people. It could be that we begin to see the other person as a possession, or at least a factor in life that we are entitled to. This idea often goes hand in hand with jealousy, which is basically a fear of loss. When this person decides to break up with us, we feel wronged and think that the reason for the breakup is in some way unjust. In case of divorce, we might especially feel wronged because our ex-spouse broke the promise of staying together until one of us dies. Also, when the breakup involves cheating, we feel betrayed. Things like monogamy and sexual exclusivity haven't always been the norm. These are mere concepts applied in social structures and part of, for example, religious traditions. And because of these concepts are part of our normative framework, of course, this feeds a sense of entitlement and fear of loss. In today's day and age, with ever-increasing sexual freedom worldwide, dating apps, and the decline of sacredness in regards to marriage, chances are high that relationships fall apart. Thus, breakups are more and more common, and so is infidelity. Stoic philosopher Epictetus had some wise words to say about how we should position ourselves towards losing the things we love. I quote, "Never say of anything, 'I've lost it,' but 'I've returned it.' Is your child dead? It is returned. Is your wife dead? She is returned. Is your estate taken away? Well, and is not the likewise returned? But he who take it away is a bad man. What difference is it to you who the giver assigns to take it back, while he gives it to you to possess? Take care of it, but don't view it as your own, just as travelers view a hotel." End quote. 3. I'll never get over that person. The excruciating pain that a breakup brings makes it seem almost impossible to get over it. But the cliché is really true. Time heals the wounds. As Stoic philosopher and ancient Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius puts it, "Some things are rushing into existence, others out of it. Some of what now exists is already gone. Change and flux constantly remake the world, just as the incessant progression of time remakes eternity." End quote. Now, the pain is something we can work with. Fighting it won't help. Instead, it's better to acknowledge that it's there. Some people apply really bad coping mechanisms. I used to do that too, especially by lots of alcohol and other mind-altering substances. But these are just quick fixes that won't help in the long run. I've also isolated myself often after a breakup, which is only good in moderation. From my own experience, ideally, dealing with the grief is a combination of active engagement with the world and moments in solitude to really sit with it. The latter is important. It's the embrace of what is, and to simply endure the detachment phase, which is a slow process that can take months or even years. In order to learn more about how the Stoics looked at the immediate grief after an unfortunate event, we might want to turn to Seneca. Seneca was not just a Stoic philosopher, he was also a statesman who held a highly powered position in the Roman Empire, until he was charged with adultery with the emperor's sister. He was exiled to Corsica. He writes to his mother to console her because she mourned his absence. I quote, "I knew that I must not oppose your grief during its first transports, lest my very attempts at consolation might irritate it and add fuel to it. For in diseases also there is nothing more hurtful than medicine applied too soon."